Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the testimony today of Donald Trump's nominee to be the next Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, a billionaire conservative political activist and major donor to Republicans, including most of the majority members of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, conducting today's hearing. Diane Ravitch, a professor in New York University Steinhardt School of Education, a former Assistant Secretary of Education under President George H.W. Bush, and author of Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools, joins us to discuss the religious zeal that underpins Betsy DeVos's determination to promote charter schools and vouchers for religious schools and homeschooling, which will further defund public schools where 85% of American kids get their education. Then we will speak with cultural critic Ruth Ben-Ghiat, a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University, who has spent decades studying authoritarian and fascist regimes. She joins us to discuss her latest article at CNN, Trump is Following the Authoritarian Playbook, and the extraordinary defense of Trump that came today from a fellow authoritarian leader, Vladimir Putin, who argued that the intelligence dossier on the president-elect was fake news because Donald Trump would only consort with high-class hookers and that Russia's prostitutes are the best in the world. Then finally, we'll look into a growing movement to resist the Trump agenda and speak with the co-author of a practical guide on how to do so. Ezra Levin, a D.C.-based domestic policy wonk who served as a congressional staffer and as the Associate Director of Federal Policy at the Corporation for Enterprise Development, joins us to discuss Indivisible, a practical guide for resisting the Trump agenda, which he co-authored with another former congressional staffer, Angel Padilla. And joining us now is Diane Ravitch, a professor in New York University Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best-known education experts. She served as Assistant Secretary for Education under George H.W. Bush and established a reputation as a conservative champion of school choice, testing standards, No Child Left Behind, and other programs claiming to make schools more efficient and effective. In her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch explains how she came to make a radical break with those policies. And her most recent book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Welcome to Background Briefing, Diane Ravitch.
Thank you so much.
And the billionaire Betsy DeVos from a very wealthy family in Michigan, very active in Republican politics, in particular in Michigan, testified today as a nominee for Secretary of Education. And this is somebody that's going to be in charge of the public schools, but it's pretty clear from her testimony that she doesn't really believe in public education. She wants to privatize education, have vouchers for charter schools and religious schools. So is this another example, like the Labor Secretary and the head of HUD, where you have people being nominated to head up government agencies whose mission they oppose?
Absolutely. Betsy DeVos is unfit to be Secretary of Education because 85% of American school children attend public schools, and she is a dedicated enemy of public schools. She has created an organization called American Federation for Children that advocates for vouchers for religious schools and for charter schools. And she's opposed to any accountability for charter schools. She and her husband, Dick DeVos, who are billionaires from the Amway pyramid scheme, they sponsored a referendum in Michigan in the year 2000 to change the state constitution to make it possible to send public funds to religious schools. And it was turned down overwhelmingly. The vote was 69-31 in opposition to changing the Constitution to permit religious vouchers. So they put a lot of energy into expanding the charter sector. And in Michigan, the charters are overwhelmingly operated for profit. 80% of the charter schools in Michigan are for-profit corporations. And when the legislature thought, well, maybe we should have some regulation, some oversight, Betsy DeVos and her husband spent over $1 million lobbying to legislators to say no regulation, no oversight. They should be free to do whatever they want to do. So this is her idea of how charters should operate, and that is with no oversight. She's a believer of a zealous believer. And first of all, in religious schooling, she has been quoted in many places saying that her mission is to advance the kingdom of God through education. Well, a lot of people don't want schools to be religious schools, and where she can't get vouchers across, she pushes for unregulated charters, and this is why Michigan has not only seen an educational disaster, but they don't have vouchers because the public wouldn't allow it, but what they do have is a continually declining achievement in Michigan as a result of her choice policies.
So one of the things that many journalists and critics of Betsy DeVos have pointed out is that many members of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee that are holding the hearings today to confirm Betsy DeVos, a number of the Republicans on this committee have received money from her because the family are big donors to Republicans and conservative causes. 5 of the 12 GOP members of that committee, Richard Burr, Lisa Murkowski, Tim Scott, Bill Cassidy, and Todd Young, received money from the DeVos family during the past 4 years. I believe also Marco Rubio has as well. So what's the sense that they're compromised? I mean...
Actually, there have been other people who've tracked down the funding that's come from the DeVos's have many pots of money. I mean, it's not just Betsy and Dick DeVos. There's a whole family, all of whom are billionaires, and they act in a coordinated way, and they have several different PACs. 10 of the 12 Republican senators have taken money, campaign contributions, from different DeVos PACs. So there's not much sense that her nomination will be turned down by the committee because they've all taken money from the foundations, or not the foundations, the political action groups of the DeVos family. But they, of course, don't stop with just the members of the Education Committee. They've also given money to Mitch McConnell, who's the Republican leader of the Senate, and spread money. And it wasn't to get Betsy DeVos confirmed because they had no idea she would be nominated. It was to build support for their idea that choice, unlimited, unregulated, unsupervised choice was itself the great reform that would somehow bring everybody, I don't know, it's hard to say what it is they expect of this, other than that if everyone makes the choice of school, then the problems will be solved. And what we know now, because we've had 25 years of vouchers in Milwaukee and Cleveland, and a long experiment with vouchers in D.C., and charters have been around now for 25 years, we now have evidence that it doesn't solve any problems. It creates new problems. So the biggest problem that it creates when you have vouchers and charters is that it draws their money is drawn from the public education fund, and it defunds the public schools.
But in terms of the money that the DeVos family gives, and Betsy DeVos wrote an article for Roll Call in which she basically said that the family expects a return on investments. And she went on to say, we do expect some things in return. We expect to foster a conservative governing philosophy consisting of limited government and respect for traditional American values. Now, it's my understanding that her and her brother, who is the founder of the mercenary outfit Blackwater, are both extremely conservative in their politics, and I'm not sure whether they're theocrats, but they're or dominionists for that matter, but they do believe in homeschooling and religious schools. So how far can you go in investigating that? Because obviously people are entitled to their personal religious views, but we're talking about a public servant here.
Right. Well, obviously everyone can pursue whatever religion they want. The danger is when someone with theocratic ideas or very, very deep religious conviction assumes a very important public role. In the case of the Secretary of Education, there's quite a lot of billions that will be under the control of the Secretary of Education. And the governor, the president-elect, Donald Trump, has said he wants to take $20 billion of federal funding, not new federal funding, but existing federal funding, and switch that over so that states can use it either for charters or vouchers. Now, normally, this might not be a problem, although you would have, as the top spokesperson for the federal government, someone who doesn't believe in public schools, which in itself is bizarre, since 85% of all American children go to public schools. But you'd have someone who is out there beating the drums for alternatives to public schooling. And where this will be tremendously important is where's the $20 billion going to come from? It's going to come from money that is currently dedicated to the education of the poorest children. That, in federal lingo, that's called Title I. It's Title I of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. That is money that would be turned to vouchers and charters. Probably another $5 billion to make up the $20 would come from money for children with disabilities. So money that is currently used specifically to aid kids in public schools would be turned into money for school choice. And if this, I would assume if the state doesn't want it for that purpose, they would say no thank you. But we now have a majority of states that are controlled by Republican governors and Republican legislatures who are all gaga for school choice. Now, the reason I say that this is all ridiculous is that if we want to be a high-performing nation on international tests, which some people say we should be, we would not be looking at school choice because none of the high-performing nations have school choice. None of them have a free market ideology. There are only two nations that have adopted a free market ideology. That's Chile under the dictator Pinochet, and Sweden when it elected a very conservative government some years ago. In both countries, they are now re-examining their education systems because what they've seen is a decline in performance and also increased segregation of every kind where children only go to school with children like themselves, based on race, based on cultural background, based on socioeconomics, based on religion. And it creates a silo effect in society. And one of the, I would say one of the goals of this society has been to teach people tolerance for and acceptance of diversity. And one of the goals of public education has been to teach children to live with others who are different from themselves. But with choice, with charters and vouchers, comes the silo effect. In other words, intensified segregation. And this is what Betsy DeVos and the Trump administration will be promoting.
Well, the DeVos family have donated significant amount of money to Christian schools and evangelical causes. Of course, most notable is Focus on the Family, which is an anti-gay organization whose founder has received thousands of dollars from the DeVoses. And he has labeled public school curricula as godless and immoral and suggested Christian teachers should leave public education. But there is an obvious trap here, and it's just so fundamentally obvious, that if you take money away from public schools and give them to either charter schools or these religious schools through vouchers, you are taking money away from public education. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy if you say that public education has failed. Oh, therefore we take money away from it to make it fail even more and even faster. I mean, that's the dynamic, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this is why when there was a vote in Massachusetts last fall at the same time as the presidential election, there was a great push. Millions and millions of dollars were spent to try to persuade people that the best way to help public education was to increase the number of charter schools. And the public got it. They understood that every dollar that went to charter schools was a dollar taken away from public schools. And Massachusetts happens to have the best public schools in the country. And people there voted overwhelmingly. It was 2-1. To say, no, we don't want more charter schools. We have quite enough, thank you, and we want to protect our public schools. So I think what we will see these next few years is a raid on the state and federal treasury to benefit religious schools and to benefit private corporations that own charter schools. And the charter sector is really been marred by terrible scandals of theft and misappropriation of dollars and fraud, and this has happened all over the country. The worst of them all, which Betsy DeVos supports, are the cyber charters. Now, California has the California, I think it's called CAVA, which is the California Virtual Academy. It's run by a corporation created by the ex-felon Michael Milken, and it's a virtual charter school, which has terrible results, high dropout rates, low graduation rates, terrible test scores, and yet it gets full tuition for every student who enrolls, and she wants more of those. So she supports everything except public schools, and I think it's a real problem for democracy because she is one of the most radical of the appointments, and she's a billionaire, a multi-billionaire. And she's the kind of person, I guess, that Donald Trump admires because she's very, very rich. But she's never been to a public school. Her own children went to religious schools. And I think that she has, she's been quoted many places as saying she wants to advance the kingdom of God through her education policies. And many parents don't want their children to be part of, if they wanted them to go to religious school, they'll send them to religious school. But public taxes shouldn't be used in that way.
Well, but it's all very well to want to advance the kingdom of God, but we don't know whether God specifically is anti-science, but a lot of his followers are in terms of religious fundamentalism and the evangelical followers like Betsy DeVos, who promote creationism instead of teaching evolution. Science is fixed on evolution. It's also settled on global warming, which is also a part of the anti-intellectual, anti-science denial industry that's very prevalent in this new Trump administration. So how can you call yourself? I mean, this is why we're becoming the land of the stupid instead of the land of the free and the home of the brave.
This is a very dangerous time for science, for knowledge, for any kind of intellectual inquiry. And it's not just because of Betsy DeVos, and I think that her religious views would be such that she would, well, let's say she would not fund anything that teaches evolution, but also, as you mentioned, her family history. Her family were among the founders. Her mother was among the founders of both Focus on the Family and also the Family Research Council, both of these being homophobic organizations. Her mother, Elsa Prince, was one of the major donors to Prop 8 in California. So there is that. But, you know, you also have to see this in the context of an administration in which virtually everyone who's been appointed to any position dealing with science is a climate change denier, you know, from the head of the Environmental Protection Agency who denies climate change to everyone else, whether it's Rick Perry, who will be running the Energy Department, Rick Perry, the former governor of Texas, his predecessor in the Energy Department was a man with a PhD in physics. I mean, typically the Energy Department has physicists running it.
And Nobel Prize winners, by the way.
Pardon?
And Nobel Prize winners.
Yes, exactly. And this is across the Trump administration. Climate change denial is common, and there have also been a lot of scientists are very concerned now about protecting the records of the government data, and there are guerrilla groups across the country and in Canada as well who are copying the databases that are publicly available from the government because they're afraid that the appointees of the Trump administration might literally wipe out the databases, or if they don't wipe them out, they'll simply stop collecting the data so there are no trend lines. So there's grave concern that science will be under assault because of this influence of the religious right and Trump's bizarre capitulation to the evangelicals in making his appointments. I say bizarre because he's not an evangelical by any means, but he's decided to treat them as his base of political power.
Well, he made a deal. It was, I'll take Mike Pence as my VP and I'll get your votes. I mean, he's a deal maker. So
yeah, well, and Mike Pence is a climate change denier.
But so is Congressman Pompeo, the new head of the CIA. And the biggest challenge facing the planet are the geopolitical changes that will take place because of global warming, massive refugee shifts, enormous social upheavals. The biggest challenge that intelligence faces is how to predict and deal with climate change. And here you have the new head of the CIA, a climate change denier. So this is willful and dangerous ignorance.
Well, you know, ExxonMobil was for a long time denying climate change, and I to this date, I think that obviously the fossil fuel is their industry. So I think that we're entering into probably the most dangerous period we've ever had in this country because of the kinds of people who are being appointed, the kind of 19th century views that they have of science, and I suspect that there are going to be a lot of challenges to people who try to teach science because they'll be told that just don't mention the word evolution, don't mention global warming, don't mention climate change, and there will be parents complaining about teachers who dare to talk about modern science.
Well, just in closing, the last sector of the education, to my mind, Arne Duncan was a tremendous failure because he did nothing about the biggest racket of all, which is the for-profit college racket that indentures young students, mostly vets and minority students, aspiring for a better life and to enter the middle class. They get these worthless diplomas if indeed they graduate and are saddled with a lifetime of debt. All the while, everything is on the public dime and all the money and profits go to these rackets who use the money to advertise and shortchange these children and end up indenturing them for life. And it's an absolute shame. And it's close to $40 billion worth of taxpayer money is wasted, or it's not even wasted, it's actually stolen in the worst possible way, with tremendous injury to a generation of young Americans. So he did nothing about that. Will this get even worse under Betsy DeVos?
Absolutely. In fact, the day after the election, the for-profit college industry, as well as the for-profit prison industry, saw an enormous jump in their stock price. Because there had been a determination by the Justice Department to phase out privatized prisons because they were more dangerous and more costly and so forth. And the Correction Corporations of America saw a big jump in its stock, and so did all of the for-profit college industry or higher education industry because they were in increasing hot water. But, you know, some of the former Obama administration officials at the top of the U.S. Department of Education actually bought the biggest for-profit company, the one that owns the University of Phoenix. So they invested in it before the election, and they stand to make huge profits because their stock soared. No, it's all very sick, and it's all very corrupt, and we just have to somehow have the courage to get through these next 4 years and stick by our principles, which are, you know, to do things that are based on evidence, to do what's in the best interest of children, and not to fall for any of this malarkey that people like Betsy DeVos and Donald Trump are peddling.
Well, Diane Ravitch, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Diane Ravitch, who's a professor at New York University Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best-known education experts. She served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush and established a reputation as a conservative champion of school choice, testing standards, No Child Left Behind, and other programs claiming to make schools more efficient and effective. In her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch explains how she came to make a radical break with these policies, and her most recent book is Reign of Error, the Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with a cultural critic who has spent decades studying authoritarian and fascist regimes.
Burning Isaac, Jesus coming. Jesus comes to pave the way. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in second chance? Do you believe in rapture, babe?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images, and has an article at CNN, Trump is following the authoritarian playbook. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
Thank you.
And you have studied fascism and authoritarian leaders now for some time, for decades, as a matter of fact. And you say that you see in Trump a deeply familiar figure, the strongman who cultivates a bond with followers based on loyalty to him as a person rather than to a party or set of principles. And that certainly seems to be the case in his choice of cabinet secretaries. Sessions' only qualification is that he was the first senator to endorse Trump and the only senator for a long time. The same is true of Governor of Texas and of Dr. Ben Carson. So there, I think we have some pretty clear evidence that I suppose in Donald Trump's case, his massive ego and self-aggrandizement is pretty inescapable, surely.
Yeah, well, it's a funny dynamic where in reality, these figures are not very secure people and they trust very few people outside of their family and a kind of network of loyalists. And it's entirely typical, for example, that Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, are going to have such outsized roles in the administration, even Jared being supposedly appointed to solve the Middle East peace problem. And this clannishness and kind of kinship to the exclusion of all others, unless politicians are let in if they, like Sessions, submitted early on, it's very typical of these people who are insecure and yet they demand that tribute be constantly paid to them.
And in terms of his pattern, for example, of refusing to release tax returns, you're arguing that there's a tactic there.
Yeah, I mean, the specific document that he won't release, you know, there are many theories, as we know, as to why he doesn't want to show those numbers and those possible business ties with foreign countries and other speculation that he's not perhaps as rich as he says he is. But beyond that, the act of refusing is a power move that I have found that authoritarians are very clear about their intentions. They tell you often what they're going to do and what they're not going to do. And if they come up in a situation of democracy, like in our situation, people either don't really know, they don't want to hear, they're a little frightened, or they are in denial, or they don't understand the type of person they're dealing with. So he refused to submit to the will of the kind of political process, and the first example was refusing the tax return release. And he's been consistent about that ever since. And it's also a kind of elevation of the self, and often these people have cults of personality, and they want to prove very clearly from the start that they're not like ordinary run-of-the-mill politicians. And so all of this other posturing that has its own reasons, where Trump doesn't want to move to the White House full-time. He doesn't want to use the Secret Service. He wants his private security. He's doing things his own way, and the burden has been on the GOP before he had the nomination to push back and make him conform to their norms. And they didn't do that, and so he went on his merry way, and now he was elected.
Well, the most visible sign of an authoritarian leader to be was recent press conference where Donald Trump went after Jim Acosta of CNN, accused him of peddling fake news and CNN of peddling fake news, and refused to answer the repeated questions from Jim Acosta. And this, of course, led to Turkey's authoritarian leader, Erdogan, praising Trump for putting, quote, Acosta in his place. So my take on that, and there's a Russian journalist who wrote a wonderful piece about it, saying, you know, to the American press, welcome to the authoritarian press conference. We've had the one under Putin for the last 12 years, and you guys are just learning what it's all about, being insulted by a strong man who creates his own rules. The point is that Trump has already set a standard, and the American press have rolled over. He set a standard where he chooses what questions he answers and from what news outlet.
That's right. And one of his advisors, Newt Gingrich, a fellow historian, had recommended early on that the White House press corps just be disbanded and Trump just communicate directly with the people, something that he does via Twitter. Now, about the CNN episode, you know, many people were shocked because they saw CNN as, in some ways, on TV, having been too soft about toward Trump, and they'd cite Jeff Zucker, the president, having a personal relationship with Trump. And so people didn't expect this to happen. But, of course, from my point of view, it was entirely predictable because every public encounter for a strongman is an opportunity to show his power and humiliate. And there's no greater joy, and you could see Trump was relishing this, he was in his element, than taking, you know, the most powerful network and putting them as his counterpart in Turkey said, in his place. And he's showing that he's not going to play by the rules. And this has been very important to Trump, as we've already spoken about. And I only hope, and kind of in my CNN article, you know, said I hope he doesn't go the way of either Vladimir Putin or the Turkish ruler Erdogan, who has, you know, actually criminalized and jailed journalists. And we can only hope that Trump will be content to simply call the shots and rearrange the rules of the game and leave it at that.
Well, the press didn't stand up for their own rights.
No.
As journalists, they should have said, you know, until you answer his question, we're not going to ask questions. And if Trump refused, they should have walked out. But there's no such solidarity,
agree.
You know, and that's unfortunate that it's all about access nowadays. And again, I'm speaking with Ruth Benkiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who's been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of image, and has an article at CNN, Trump is following the authoritarian playbook. So let's talk about Berlusconi. Since you're an Italian scholar, you know him well.
Yeah.
How does he compare? By the way, he was, until Trump came along, Berlusconi was Putin's best buddy.
That's right. Then they have a very close relationship. They vacation together, and these strongmen like to hang out together. They see in each other a kindred spirits, and so it's not at all surprising that the Trump-Putin kind of bromance, as they say, is taking off and has been for some time. Well, Berlusconi is, I think he's very important as a kind of hinge, you know, in the 1990s and early 2000s between kind of older strongmen and what you have now, where you have this person, Berlusconi, who had a brand, who had made it, in, you know, as a media mogul, a sports mogul, and came in with this great roster of conflicts of interest, and proceeded to not really solve any of them and refused to solve any of them and was tied up with legal troubles, thousands of cases throughout his on and off, you know, rule of Italy. And he did many of the same things in terms of, you know, Twitter wasn't around then, but he communicated very effectively with the same kind of sarcastic humor and performances as Trump does. So these... they know how to manipulate the media and reach the people in a direct way, and people, they're very popular.
So what do you think, given that they go after the law, and already Trump, of course, went after a federal judge who he mm-hmm. maligned as being Mexican, even though he was born in Indiana, and he's had extraordinary legal troubles, and he's very proactive in terms of using the law rather vindictively. So how do you see him in terms of an authoritarian leader in the American context? He certainly, the Republicans have, this is one of the things, by the way, that that President Obama lamented the other day in one of his, I think it was on the 60 Minutes interview. He said, you know, the Republicans got away with stealing a Supreme Court justice appointee from me. And they got it, and it took a year, and nobody in the public seemed to be worried. So this is the scary part. Authoritarian leaders only arrive on the scene unless and until people give them permission to do so.
That's a very good point. And I covered the whole presidential campaign for CNN, writing after every convention and debate back from when there were many candidates in the GOP, specializing in the GOP. And I hammered the message that the GOP bears a huge amount of responsibility for what I predicted would happen, because Trump was testing the GOP, the political class, as well as the public and the media, and this is what these people do. When he appeared in a speech a year ago and said that he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and not lose any voters, it was, you know, it behooves the GOP to stand up and disqualify him immediately. He's threatening to shoot someone. And instead, they thought that they could use him, and he sits very uneasily with the GOP. He calls his followers a movement. I don't think he cares at all about the GOP. They're kind of his host. And so the GOP failed the test at every turn, thinking out of opportunism or delusion that they could just use Trump. And they have been very aggressive, thinking that he's going to allow them to have power and get what they really want, which is Supreme Court justices and other reforms. So they have an enormous amount of responsibility to take in whatever happens in our country over the next years.
Well, just in the last minute, a fellow authoritarian leader, Vladimir Putin, came to Trump's rescue today, arguing that the intelligence dossier on the president-elect was fake news because Donald Trump would only consort with high-class hookers and that Russia's prostitutes are the best in the world. Quoting Putin, "I find it hard to imagine he ran to a hotel to meet our girls of low social responsibility, though they are, of course, also the best in the world." Can you believe that?
Yeah, this is, you know, this is just protecting each other. And you know, one difference with Russia is that they have had a repressive government in one form and another for almost a century. The Russians pioneered the art of propaganda. You know, they came into power, the communists, a few years before the fascists did. And they are experts, and back when it was photo manipulation, they really are superb at fake news, fake images, and they have a long history of doing this. So that's one big difference with Russia and our country, which partly accounts for the public feeling very confounded and confused at what's going on.
Well, Ruth Ben-Ghiat, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of image, and has an article at CNN, "Trump is Following the Authoritarian Playbook." We can take a brief station break. We're back looking into the growing movement to resist the Trump agenda and speak with the co-author of A Practical Guide on How to Do So.
Tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one thing I know: the poll tax and Jim Crow and greed have got to go. You're bound to lose.
We've all seen enough. Now it's time to decide the meekness of love or the power of pride. It doesn't matter if you're good or smart. God damn it, things fall apart.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ezra Levin, a D.C.-based domestic poverty policy wonk. He served as the Corporation for Enterprise Development's Associate Director of Federal Policy and Deputy Policy Director for Congressman Lloyd Doggett and an AmeriCorps VISTA in the Homeless Services Division of the San Jose Housing Department. He is the co-author with Angel Padilla of Indivisible, A Practical Guide for Resisting Trump's Agenda. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ezra Levin.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be on.
Well, thank you, Ezra. And now that Donald Trump's about to become president, and he's obviously got enormous amount of core support, even though he's a minority president, they're very active. They don't seem to care about the possibility that Putin may have compromised Trump, and they love the way that he is at war with the press, etc. So he seems unstoppable within his own world. But how is he stoppable in terms of the majority who didn't vote for this president, whose policies and preferences are going to be trampled on in a wholesale manner?
The short answer is he's quite stoppable. The fundamental truth about how federal policy is made is that Donald Trump's agenda does not depend on Donald Trump. It depends on the U.S. Congress, that's the Senate and the House of Representatives. They have to say yes to Donald Trump's agenda. And the great thing about Congress, and there are only a few great things about Congress, but one of the great things about Congress is that it is responsive to the people, that every single citizen in the United States, assuming you're outside of D.C., and I live in D.C., so I make that exception explicit here, but just about every single citizen in the United States has two senators and one representative, and they care more than anything, those senators and representatives, about reelection, which means they care about what their constituents think. So what the Indivisible Guide is really about is about giving tools to those constituents to ensure that they can make their voice heard. And it's modeled more or less on what the Tea Party did 8 years ago to stop an incredibly popular president with huge congressional majorities. What the progressive movement faces now is not that. We face a very weak president. We face a president who is historically unpopular with incredibly small majorities in the Senate and House. So we believe that the same tools that the Tea Party used 8 years ago to stop President Obama can actually be used to protect and defend democracy now by the progressive movement.
Well, when you say incredibly small, I get a smile on my face because this is the man to whom everything is incredibly huge and is quite sensitive about any reference to anything small. So let's go through your Indivisible, A Practical Guide for Resisting the Trump Agenda. The main points are how grassroots advocacy worked to stop Obama, how your member of Congress thinks and how to use that to save democracy, organize a local group to fight for your congressional district, and four local advocacy tactics that actually work. So let's begin with the first.
Yeah, so the way that we start out here is by placing our current moment in some historical context, looking at how the Tea Party used a very simple strategy and some pretty darn simple tactics to stop an incredibly popular president. So their strategy was twofold. One, they recognized that their power was local power, that members of Congress had to respond to them. So they implemented a strategy that was incredibly focused on just their two senators, just focused on their two senators, and just focused on their representative. And then the second piece of their strategy was a very defensive approach. They recognized back in 2009 that the Tea Party wasn't setting the federal policy agenda. They didn't have that power. The Democrats, who then controlled the Senate and the House and the presidency, they were setting the agenda. And any attempt by the Tea Party to choose which one of their backwards policies to focus on, that would fracture their coalition. So instead they said, we're not going to try to focus on any individual policy. Instead, we're just going to play defense and be responsive to what's happening in the moment, what Congress is focusing on this week. And to do that, they implemented just a handful of, again, pretty simple tactics. It's not rocket science. It's showing up at your local member of Congress's district office. Every member of Congress has several district offices, and you can go to any one of them. They're public places. The second idea that they had was, why don't we show up at local events when the member of Congress wants to cut a ribbon for a new building being constructed or kiss a baby? Let's not let them get positive press out of that. Let's ask them why they're not responding to us. Similar to that, there are public events and town halls where the members of Congress try to make clear that they're listening to their constituents. That's great. The constituents should make them listen. And today, as progressives are going out into their communities and meeting with their members of Congress, they should make sure that those members of Congress are resisting Donald Trump. And the last piece of this is the simplest one of all. It's just flooding the congressional phone lines with calls when bad things are happening. And I will say, this isn't just theory, and it's not just history. We've seen this work already in this Congress. On the very first day of the 115th Congress, which was last Tuesday, the Republican Congress tried to gut the Congressional Ethics Office. And in response, there was a massive wave of calls and visits to local congressional offices from folks who said, this is unacceptable. And you know what happened? It's exactly what we would think would happen in this situation. Congress backed down. They backed down because they saw that constituents were not accepting their moves. It worked again this week. They were trying to push through a handful of President Trump's appointees who had not passed ethics clearance yet. And there was massive outreach. People, again, visited their congressional offices and again flooded the phones of members of Congress. And they had to delay. They delayed several. The Secretary of Education nominee, the Secretary of Commerce, the Secretary of Labor, these were all supposed to be rammed through, and they've all been delayed. That's not because suddenly the members of Congress just decided they wanted to do the right thing on their own. That happened because their constituents made their voices heard. And we believe this is what's got to characterize the next several weeks, months, and years of the Trump administration.
Now, in terms of the Tea Party, though, I remember how they intimidated their congresspeople and also used the threat of primarying them in a primary, and that really gets the attention of an incumbent. So given, for example, here in Los Angeles, most of the congresspeople are Democrats, and you know they're in the minority now. So how do you influence the other side? And in other words, don't you, as a Democrat, don't you want to influence the agenda of the Republicans and somehow convince people who vote for these Republicans that maybe they shouldn't, or they, at least they should, at the very least, hold their feet to the fire, particularly if they're going to take away your health care?
Yeah, so one of the most common questions we've had over the last few weeks since we've put out the guide is, what do I do if my member is in a, you know, a deep blue district, or what do I do if my member is in a deep red district, or what do I do if my member is okay on some issues and not great on others? And, you know, we have two answers to that, and the first answer is the same for all of them, and that is every single member of Congress, regardless of where they are on the ideological spectrum, has to run for re-election. So they're all thinking about how their constituents and how local media thinks about them. That means that these strategies, that local defensive strategy focused on your own member of Congress, that works regardless of who your member is. They're going to respond to that stimuli because they all have that same interest. Now, the second answer to that question, though, is that the impact of that strategy will be slightly different depending on what type of member you have. So in the case of L.A. and California more generally, you've got very progressive members of the House in general, although there are exceptions, and you've got progressive members of the Senate to some extent as well. In California and in other blue states, the role of advocates right now is to implement this strategy and these tactics in order to make your members of Congress as bold as possible. You want them fighting tooth and nail against the Trump agenda. And the way you can do that is by providing positive reinforcement, which is incredibly rare in Congress. When I was a congressional staffer, we heard a lot from members who were really unhappy. We didn't hear that much from folks who were really happy with what we were doing. That's just not folks, the nature of people to let us know when we're doing the right thing. But I will say, when we did hear from those folks, those letters got printed. Those letters got shown to the chief of staff and the member of Congress, and we were excited to get them. If you want your member of Congress to be loudly opposing the Trump agenda, the best thing you can do is focus on them and tell them when they're doing a good job so they stay bold. On the Republican side, look, they're running for re-election too. So if you happen to have a conservative Republican representative, they're going to care what you think, even if you're not right in line with them ideologically. So if a large group of folks goes over to the member of Congress's office and says, hey, we really don't like that you're partnering with Trump to gut the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau or eliminate health insurance for 22 million Americans, they very well may be less bold in supporting that agenda. So the bottom line here is that there is nothing special about a very conservative member of Congress or a very liberal member of Congress when it comes to re-election. They all, in the end, face the polls. So we strongly recommend that constituents focus in on their own members of Congress, because that's where their power is and that's where they're going to have impact.
So let's then turn to local advocacy tactics that actually work.
The local advocacy tactics that work are tactics that we saw firsthand the Tea Party use. And when I say we, I mean me, I mean Angel Padilla, I mean Leah Greenberg, I mean Jeremy Hale, and I mean all of the rest of the former congressional staffers and other advocates who helped write the guide. We all kind of came of age during the rise of the Tea Party as staffers in Congress, and we saw these tactics work. The very first one that we put in there is town halls. Now, almost every member of Congress holds these things called town halls. They're also referred to as listening sessions. It's where a member of Congress goes to Culver City and says, I'm going to listen to my constituents here. Please come on by this public event and let me know your thoughts. Now, traditionally, very few people actually show up. And what the Tea Party figured out is, we can go and show up, and we can make it clear that we're not happy with what's coming out of Congress. It's a relatively easy thing to do. You show up with 5 or 10 or 15 of your friends, and you go and you ask questions, and you make clear that you're not happy with what Congress is doing. Now, the great thing about this is it's a way to get one-on-one FaceTime with the member of Congress, and it's also a way to change the narrative that's playing out locally in local media. So oftentimes local media will come to these events and cover it and write up some kind of story that looks like Congressman so-and-so is listening to constituents and talked about how he's working to improve their lives. And the member of Congress's office loves that. That's why they do these events. The opportunity for constituents opposing the Trump agenda now is to change that narrative so that the article coming out in the local press isn't Congressman so-and-so really understands his constituents. It's Congressman so-and-so is protested by people who want to thwart President Trump's agenda and want to prevent Congressman so-and-so from empowering this time. The same goes for other events. The other three tactics we look at are all around the same lines. There are public events where the member of Congress is opening up a new building or making a speech, something of that nature. There are also opportunities to go to the district office directly. Every single member of Congress has one or more district offices, and you can just show up and ask to talk to the member of Congress or ask to talk to his staff. And they have to listen to you because fundamentally they work for you. The last piece is just making calls. And we've seen the calls, we've seen the office districts meetings, we've seen the town hall visits all work. These things are magic, apparently, from the point of view of people on the outside. But from those of us who worked on the inside, we know that members of Congress really respond to these kinds of actions.
So where can people get hold of Indivisible, a practical guide for resisting the Trump agenda?
We have a website, indivisibleguide.com. I will say the guide is free. It's open source. It's Creative Commons. It means you can go in and download it as a PDF. You can download a Spanish language version. We have an audio version coming out. We have a Spanish audio version coming out. You can take it and edit it and make it your own. all we want to do is help the real leaders at the local level put this into action. So please visit indivisibleguide.com and get started with your local group.
And just in closing, the media, the mainstream media, gave Donald Trump $5 billion worth of free media and helped propel him into the White House. And Stephen Bannon is quite clever with the use of Facebook and social media. In many ways, that's how he helped to elect Trump with far less money spent than Hillary Clinton did. So what tips do you have for activists like yourself who want to stop the Trump agendas using media more creatively?
Yeah, so what we've seen so far is that local and national media is hungry. They're hungry for stories about what's happening at the local level to resist the Trump agenda. So if there is real organic energy out there, if there are actually groups going out and meeting in large numbers and going to public events to resist Trump's agenda, they want to hear about it. We've seen this already, again, at both at the local level and at the national level. And we in D.C., working on this Indivisible project, will do everything we can to highlight those voices. So there are a few things you can do locally, and there are a few things you can do if you want help from us. Locally, you should start building relationships with those local members of the press. Twitter is a great tool for doing that. You just get on Twitter and start letting the journalists in your area know that you're planning a public meeting of your group, or you're planning to go to a public event of your member of Congress or to their district office, and they're going to be interested in that. Another really helpful exercise is to take a video or take a picture of what you're doing. If you don't have it on video or picture, it didn't happen. It's really hard to convince folks that there was actually an event that occurred. So being sure that you have somebody in your group who's recording this and creating nice short and sweet clips is going to be a great way to get local and national media to feature your actions. Now, if you're also wanting help spotlighting your actions on the ground, you can lean on us too. We're happy to help, and we want to be a resource however we can. So if you email over to press.indivisible@gmail.com and let us know that you're reaching out to press, let us know that you have a video or a picture of your action, we'll get back to you and try to connect you to other press opportunities, because we want your voice heard. To the extent that it can be the local leaders talking and not us to media, that's a victory for us.
Well, Ezra Levin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ezra Levin, who's a D.C.-based domestic poverty policy wonk. He served as the Corporation for Enterprise Development's Associate Director of Federal Policy, Deputy Policy Director for Congressman Lloyd Doggett, and an AmeriCorps Vista in the Homeless Services Division of the San Jose Housing Department. And he is the co-author with Angel Padilla of Indivisible, A Practical Guide for Resisting the Trump Agenda. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.